Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Don Gagne. It's Here and Now. The Texas House is meeting for a special session today without the Democrats. House Democrats have left the state. It's their latest move to prevent the Republican-led legislature from passing new voting restrictions in a special session called by Republican Governor Greg Abbott. And we're joined now by Democratic Texas Representative Toni Rose from Dallas. She's in Washington, D.C. with at least 50 other Texas Democrats. Representative Rose, welcome. And I understand you're in the Rayburn office building by the U.S. Capitol.
Yes, I am.
So why did you and your fellow Democrats decide to leave the state last night?
Well, Don, we really didn't have a choice. After seeing the hearing that went on for about 24 hours and over 300 witnesses came and many of them testified against the bill. And once the bill was voted out, they did not accept any of the amendments from my Democratic colleagues. And so we felt that we had to protect the freedom to vote. And so we took a chance, hoping that coming to Washington, we could show the urgency of them needing to pass John Lewis Voting Rights Act and H.R. 1.
I'd like your description of the voting restrictions Republican lawmakers in Texas want to pass and why you object to them.
They would restrict voting. This past election cycle in Harris County, they were creative and very innovative during COVID and allowed voting locations to be open for 24 hours. And they saw that it was a large number of minorities who utilized that. And so you would think that you would want to encourage more voting, but instead they want to make those restrictions and ban 24-hour voting in Texas.
And I understand there would be more power to partisan poll watchers, keeping an eye on
absolutely.
Polling sites around the state.
Yes. A person could be voting and poll watchers can come over and watch them vote. And we know that intimidation would come with that.
And what about criminal penalties for people who maybe make a mistake, vote in the wrong place, vote if they're not properly registered?
All of those things are in the bill as well. They would increase penalties for making a simple mistake. If you decide to take voters to a voting location, you have to now sign an affidavit stating that you took these individuals to a polling location. So it's just so many things that are horrific in this bill that would just cause suppression.
I'm going to play a piece of tape here from Republican Texas Representative Beth Van Dyne. She was on Fox News this morning. We'll play it, then I'd like you to react.
To not do your job, to just take
off
and go hide, you know, behind Biden or Vice President Harris up in D.C., it's a dereliction of their duty. It's completely ignoring their responsibilities and their promise and commitment to their voters and their constituents, quite honestly.
Actually, we're really going above and beyond the duty of for what our constituents elected us to do. My constituents have reached out to me to ask me to take any measure necessary to stop this horrific bill. It's our duty to protect our constituents, and that's what we're doing by saying no to HB 3.
Is there any way Democrats might have been able to stay to negotiate changes to this bill, to come to some sort of compromise with Republicans?
We've tried to negotiate to no avail, and so we felt, again, this was the best solution to really try to press upon Congress to pass, you know, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act and H.R. 1 so that they could protect all of the United States, all of the states, because it's not just in Texas.
To bring a halt to this legislation, you had to leave the state, but you chose to come to Washington. What's your agenda while in D.C.?
Well, as we speak, members are meeting with senators. I believe we have a group of people who are going to meet with Senator Schumer as well. You know, we had a group that came in, a delegation that came a couple of weeks ago. And so we just brought more reinforcement to express the urgency of the need to pass the act.
I know you support the For the People Act, but Senate Democrats don't have the votes to pass that right now. What do you realistically hope will happen with that and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act?
again, I believe when my colleagues came a couple of weeks ago, they moved the needle. And we're just trying to continue to push it a little bit further. A lot of things have changed in the past couple of weeks. There was a person in Texas who was arrested for voting, didn't even realize he wasn't eligible to vote. He had been released from prison and had served his time and was ineligible to vote due to being on parole and was arrested. It's just the horrific things that they're doing to block people from voting has to be stopped. And it needs to be done on a federal level because, as I stated, it doesn't just impact Texas. It impacts other states as well.
Say you're successful this time in blocking it. There'll be another legislative session. Is this just the way it's going to be?
Each special session brings on different challenges, and we'll deal with that challenge at that time. But right now, we're trying to get Congress to act today or soon.
Toni Rose is a Democrat from the Texas House of Representatives. Thank you for speaking with us, Representative.
Thank you so much.
In Haiti, the search continues for those behind the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse, who was shot to death in his home last week. The president's death sent shockwaves through the Haitian diaspora spread across the world. Katiana Anglade is the Development and Operations Director for the nonprofit Lambie Fund of Haiti. She's in New York City, but still has family and friends in the country. Katiana, welcome.
Thank you.
And how are Haitians living in the United States that you know doing with this news of the turmoil in your native country?
Disheartened, emotional, because it's just, it's quite unbelievable. Every time we feel like there is just a little bit of progress, we're set back. And this was a hard hit for a lot of people.
Tell me what you were doing and what your reaction was when you heard that the president had been assassinated.
I was actually asleep. I woke up around 7 a.m. and just, you know, out of habit, checked my cell phone. A close friend of mine sent a link, and the link said, you know, the president was assassinated in his home. Of course, I kind of blew it off because I had never heard of that media outlet before. And I said, this must be just fake. It can't be real. So, of course, I started to do my own research and I started looking online and everyone is sharing. And I read it and it was just I was in a state of shock and disbelief.
Once that news set in, did it come as a surprise to you that this could happen in Haiti?
You know, somewhat of a surprise, but also not shocked, because greed is just it's an ugly monster. It's a very strong thing that has been driving a lot of folks in Haiti. So it wasn't that surprising, but also this is a person who was about to end his term. Why at this point? How and why did this happen?
One of the concerns at this point now is that Haiti will become so destabilized that people will feel compelled to leave the country. You have friends and family in Haiti. What are you hearing from them? Do they feel safe now since this has happened?
They haven't felt safe since before this happened. This isn't anything new. But now it's like we're in a tunnel. Can we even see the light at the end of this tunnel? What's going to happen next? I think that's the scariest part of people living on the ground, is what happens next.
Do you think people will feel compelled to leave?
They've been felt compelled to leave. That's, you know, it's been happening. But there's, where are they going to go? Visas aren't being handed out anymore, not even just for residency, visiting visas for family members. And they've been denied over and over again just to kind of get them out to either seek medical attention here in the States. And they've been denied. So, of course, they're going to want to flee and just leave. But where? Where to?
Do you trust the Haitian authorities to carry out this investigation and bring justice to the people who did this?
At this point, we don't have much of a choice but to trust those who are investigating. I think we can kind of lean back on history and see that a lot of people are untrustworthy. And, you know, for something to happen of this magnitude where the president has the ultimate security, who was calling the shots on this one? So can we really trust anybody to do this investigation? I can't even answer that. But at this point, the world is watching. Every Haitian citizen in the diaspora is watching.
Well, and speaking of history, Haiti is asking for help from the United States, and you well know that that relationship is complicated for decades and in a century even. What should the U.S. government, in your opinion, be doing to help?
At this point, if the United States or anyone else wants to intervene or provide any type of assistance, they're going to have to listen to the Haitian people. And if anybody's going to come in and help, there has to be some sort of a roundtable to say, you know, the agricultural sector needs to come up. People from the countryside need to come up. Their voices need to be heard at this point so that they can say, this is what we need.
And you have an insight into this because your organization has advocated for improved economic conditions in Haiti, increased availability of food, attempts at reforestation, technical training for women. Knowing what you know, what are your concerns about the future of the country now and for its people?
A lot is needed. I do know that the process of handing out, the handouts haven't worked for years. Our model is one that has worked. It's a bottom-up approach where we approach the people or actually the grassroots organizations approach us and they tell us this is what we need. So I believe that that same model can be used in a sense in helping to develop Haiti. Their voices need to be heard and we need to take the lead from them, from the people. It works.
Katiana Anglad is the Development and Operations Director for the nonprofit group Lambi Fund of Haiti, talking about the Haitian diaspora's reaction to news that the president has been assassinated. Katiana, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Consumer prices jumped by 5.4% in June, according to the Labor Department, the biggest monthly rise in 13 years. The sharp increase is due in part to supply chain disruptions and a surge in demand as pandemic restrictions are lifted across the country. Robin Farzad is here to explain what's happening. He's host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Don, how are you?
I'm great. So what's driving this surge in prices and high inflation?
When you have a ton of money suddenly sluicing into limited goods and services, you're invariably going to see prices go up. And it's a seller's market, whether you're selling essential semiconductors, you're sending contracting work or home inspection labor, even that short order cook whose labor makes or breaks a diner that is finding it can't make customer demand without that capacity. Used cars, anything in hospitality, especially when airlines and hotels were the first to slash capacity more than a year ago. And so this is the reckoning for that, however temporary or permanent.
So even with all of that, the rise was higher than was expected. What did forecasters not take into account?
I think the dovish case has consistently been, well, we're coming out of an unprecedented economic shutdown and then a snapback. So you're bound to have bottlenecks. And these price hikes, they're saying, are temporary. Supply and demand is going to rediscover a kind of a meeting point and will revert to something approximating a pre-COVID normal. But Don, that's hard to square with a stat we saw. 47% of small businesses said that they raised average selling prices in June. That's the highest clip since 1981, which was a very scary year indeed for inflation.
Okay, so what does it mean for Americans? What's going up in price the most? How much more are we going to be out of pocket for some basic needs?
Americans are feeling the hit with cars, both to purchase and to rent. Eating out, where we're seeing menu costs creep up. Outside of core inflation, which of course excludes volatile food and energy prices, you can certainly feel it at the pump. At a national average of $3.15 a gallon for unleaded, that's a bit over a year after. I think no one was much using petroleum. So you sense this pattern. The big question is how much of this sticks and causes a vicious cycle when COVID hopefully is far in the rearview mirror.
I'd completely forgotten what a meal costs anyway. So the Federal Reserve has repeatedly argued inflation is being driven by transitory factors that will eventually settle down. What are those transitory factors?
You know, the rust and cobwebs of the pandemic lockdown and the various changes to work. How long is it going to take for restaurants to rally back staff? If staff wants to come back, and for how much? How long is it going to take automakers to get essential parts to fill up these lots? Will the price hikes in restaurants beget a vicious cycle of pay hikes and price hikes and pay hikes and price hikes? These are all multi-trillion dollar questions with the Fed indeed right now at full stimulus.
Although prices for a range of goods are likely to remain high for a while, there are also signs that some of the impact from inflation may be starting to ease. When can we really expect that to start happening in a big way?
September 6th is a critical date. That's when the federal unemployment bonus runs out for millions of Americans. I mean, at least those whose states haven't already opted out. If you take $300 per week of that financial aid, that amounts to an additional $750 per hour for a person who was otherwise working for 40 hours. So do they head back to work on current terms. What about school reopening and their kids? You're going to see a lot of parental consternation in about a month and a half.
And maybe to step back a little bit, the Labor Department also reports today that wages were down by 0.5% from May to June. Is that connected to the spike in inflation?
Yeah, that spike of inflation, however transitory, it's corrosive. Workers are now feeling negative real wages when, you know, average hourly earnings after inflation fell 0.5% for the month. And so it's more than negated by the jump in the consumer price index. Are workers and consumers going to eat this, or will they successfully get raises?
Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Don.
Summer vacation season is underway, and in China, that means red tourism, which draws people to sites important to the Chinese Communist Party's history. This month, the party turns 100 years old, so NPR's Emily Fang visited some of these sites to learn what history has to say about the future.
I'm standing at a grand stone plaza when I meet a local retired history professor, He Siyu. He's leading a group of party members to sing revolutionary red songs.
Even though we're retired, we still have the responsibility to carry on the revolutionary spirit.
The revolutionary spirit is supposed to be especially strong here, in Zunyi. In 1935, the communists took over the city, and they held a conference where Mao Zedong began to take control over the Communist Party, moving it away from the control of Soviet Russia. Mao also beat back other ambitious Chinese officials. Now, on the eve of the party's 100th birthday, Professor He has come to the conference site to wish the party strength to face the new challenges that are cropping up.
Whether it's the issue of Xinjiang or Hong Kong or Tibet, foreign forces have inevitably created anti-China sentiment. But within China, these are non-issues because of the strong leadership of the Communist Party.
The Chinese state has refurbished some 180 or so officially designated red tourism sites like this one in the last decade. Sites like the Yan'an Caves, where the communists lived for 13 years, or the pit stops along the route to Yan'an. Red tourism is not just an exercise in patriotism. It's a way to prove the political pedigree of party leaders like Chairman Mao and increasingly current leader Xi Jinping, who was China's most powerful leader since Mao.
To put it succinctly, Chairman Mao rose as leader of the Communist Party here in Sunyi. Without Mao, China's path forward would have been very difficult.
This is Wang Xiu, a red tourist here who's dressed up in a rented costume to look like a revolutionary soldier. He explains Zunyi is where Mao Zedong thought was first brought up, the party's guiding philosophy that Marxism could be adapted to Chinese society, not just European industrial ones.
Our current leader, Xi Jinping, is the inheritor of the political road set out by Mao Zedong thought, which all started here.
Justifying the right to rule is not so clear-cut in nominally communist systems. There are no popular elections to choose leaders, and unlike a monarchy, the title of party chairman is not inherited. Instead, leaders must demonstrate their connection and loyalty to communist history and their commitment to revolution. Many red tourism sites like Zunyi celebrate Chairman Mao as the inevitable choice, the only person who could have led China. From Zunyi, communist soldiers fled over thousands of miles of dirt roads and icy mountains to here, the city of Yan'an and the heartland of China's northern plains. The Long March, as the trek is now called, has taken on biblical status in party lore. And once in Yan'an, the party managed to survive in the area's barren plains. Today, tourists clamor for pictures and reenact scenes of their manual labor. Here's Sun Wei, an oil and gas engineer, tilling soil for pumpkin sprouts, as his communist ancestors would have done 90 years ago.
Activities like this increase our sense of teamwork and cooperation.
These acts of valor and grit are meant to inspire a new generation of communists. And current party leaders and low-level cadres make annual trips here to burnish the revolutionary credentials. In 1969, a then 16-year-old Xi Jinping came here too, though not by his own choice. Xi Jinping is now the leader of China, but as this tour guide explains, during violent political purges in the 1960s, he was sent to a Yan'an village. He was one of about 17 million young adults ordered to serve rural peasants during this period, called the Cultural Revolution. The village is tiny, a few hundred residents who once lived in mud and clay houses on the plains. It's now an open-air shrine to Xi, with a parking lot that can accommodate hundreds of buses. Tourists can visit the metalworking cooperative Xi helped found to make modern farming tools. They can also see the covered well Xi dug to turn animal waste into natural gas. Xi Jinping dug the well with his own hands. Take a look, the tourist tells me. And of course, visitors can see the humble caves dug directly into the hard earth that Xi and other cadres lived in for nearly 7 years here. Hung on the cave walls is a picture of Chairman Mao, leader Deng Xiaoping, and then finally, Xi. It's like a political family tree. Xi as the equal of, and the next generation too, two other foundational party leaders. Tourist Yu Anli likes the arrangement.
Chairman Mao had almost magical abilities and amazing foresight. He saw China's big changes would fall on the next generation of leaders, like Xi Jinping.
32-year-old Liu Yunwen has come with her office mates to learn about Xi Jinping too.
For us younger generation, there's some emotional distance from Chairman Mao. But we're living at a time when Xi Jinping is at the core of the party. So we experience his leadership more viscerally.
Even for non-believers, the message at red tourism sites like this one is clear. Serve the party as well as Xi Jinping did and rise high. But not too high. After all, there can be only one chairman. Emily Fang, NPR News, Zunyi, China.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
Support groups for people with dementia are usually held in person, but that changed during the pandemic. It turns out, though, there was a silver lining to that. Kathy Ritchie from member station KJZZ tells us how some people caring for loved ones with dementia are finding themselves getting support for the very first time.
Brandon Felt is not your typical 25-year-old.
I am, I would say, a caregiver, full-time student, and I manage overall health care for my mom, who has frontal temporal dementia.
Or FTD, which is a lesser-known type of early-onset dementia that can affect language, behavior, and movement. Her first symptoms started in 2015, and the following year, she needed full-time care at age 58. Brandon was only 19 at the time.
I was in my first year of college. I had to drop out just in order to manage her diagnostic journey.
Which can mean countless doctor's appointments, tests, and in the case of Brandon's mom, a brain biopsy. And at the time, he didn't have a lot of support. Even though he knew about the support groups offered at the Research Center at the University of California in San Diego, where his mom was receiving care.
But I wasn't able to participate in it because I was just so busy. Like, I had 10 things to do and only had time to get 8 of them done. And so I couldn't add, you know, getting support on top of that.
But the coronavirus pandemic changed everything. Those in-person meetings went virtual. And for the first time, Brandon was able to participate in a support group.
The increase of availability of these support groups allowed me to kind of refocus on myself, take care of myself, and actually start to process some of the emotions that I had set aside during that time when I was not able to process them.
And he's been able to connect with others who are facing similar struggles. Tracy Trescott is a licensed social worker at the Shiley Marcos Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at UCSD. She leads some of the support groups there.
It's a different group, yes, but it's more people. We have a lot more people joining.
And they're joining from all over the country.
And we're also seeing, which I hadn't seen before, whole families being involved in the support group for the one person.
And that's a big deal, says Trescott, because often the dynamic can play out like this. One person is a primary caregiver. They're living with or near the person who has dementia. The siblings live far away and may not understand the day-to-day challenges. Then conflict ensues. But let's circle back to Brandon. His mother has a lesser-known type of dementia, FTD. Luckily, he can take his mother to a place where the providers understand FTD and its challenges. But there are only so many FTD-specific clinics around the country. Bridget Moran McCabe is a support services manager at the Association for Frontotemporal Degeneration. She says those clinics have seen a surge in participants since going virtual.
So, for instance, you know, Massachusetts General has a large FTD center, and the support group that is affiliated with that clinic, they've been getting up to 50 people a month.
And doing a great job of managing that, she says, by getting more volunteers to host smaller breakout rooms. Of course, the association has had its share of challenges. Many of the AFTD support groups are led by active caregivers. And when everything closed, including adult day centers and other respite services,
that meant that, you know, some of them had to step away because their role got so much more intense.
More than a year has passed since virtual support groups started popping up across the country, and they're likely here to stay. Licensed social worker Tracy Truscott says, if anything, they'll have some type of hybrid support with both in-person and virtual options. And for caregivers like Brandon Felt, accessing support groups around the country is a lifeline in an otherwise isolating situation. For Here and Now, I'm Kathy Ritchie in Phoenix.
Yesterday, we heard about marching season in Northern Ireland, a chance for Protestant unionists who've long held the reins of power to publicly demonstrate their support for the crown and antagonize Catholic Republicans that want to reunite Ireland. But as we've learned, Brexit has complicated that history. Marcher Ian McLaughlin told NPR that any effort to reunite the North with the Republic of Ireland would fail.
I don't believe that this island will ever be reunited peacefully. The trajectory of peace, in my opinion, has stalled.
Well, our next guest writes that Northern Ireland, which celebrates its 100th anniversary this year, may not last another decade. Journalist Susan McKay is based in Northern Ireland. Susan, welcome.
Thank you.
Yesterday, when we spoke with our correspondent in Belfast, Frank Langfitt, he told us that the crowds at marching season, that they were more subdued this year, and that, by his accounts, many of the marchers were older. And I wonder what you make of that and what happens to their movement when that generation is gone.
This is a very good question. To some extent, the crowds were smaller at the 12th of July parades because of COVID. But the reality is the Protestant community is aging, and the Orange Order and the other loyal order organizations are not seeing young people joining up in significant numbers. One of the problems for unionism and for the loyal orders is that their social conservatism no longer appeals to particularly younger generations of people who have a much more global outlook. You know, their imaginations are being informed by a much wider range of sources than they would have been in the past. So, you know, you've got a lot of young people in Northern Ireland who are preoccupied with climate justice and with climate change, and they're preoccupied by feminism as an international movement, things like that. And they're not interested in a kind of narrow conservative politics which excludes Catholics, as the Orange Order does, and which is based on traditional family values, which is anti-LGBTQ+, anti-same-sex marriage, anti-abortion. You know, the young people just don't find that attractive. So that's a problem for unionism, is that it's no longer even appealing to Protestants.
And so you've written an article, an essay in the New York Times with a provocative headline. You say, it is the end of Northern Ireland. Do you think the terms are really that stark?
I think the terms very much are that stark, because Northern Ireland, this was supposed to be the centenary of Northern Ireland. It was supposed to be a big time of celebration for unionists. But instead, what they're facing is the reality that Brexit has seriously disrupted the peace process in Northern Ireland. There's a great deal of anxiety in all communities, but particularly among unionists, about the fact that we are now potentially facing into, sometime in the next few years, a poll on the future constitutional status of Northern Ireland. And we could see a vote of a majority of people for a united Ireland at some stage over the next number of years. This has come about because of a number of factors. One of them is Brexit, which has been very destabilizing. The other is demographics. We're likely looking at a census outcome this year, which will show that there is a slight Catholic majority, and it's a growing Catholic majority because of the aging Protestant population.
And I think it's important that we go back and sketch out quickly some of the history between these two groups. In the latter half of the 20th century, the troubles between Protestant Unionists and Catholic Nationalists dominated people's lives. Nearly 4,000 people died in sectarian fighting. Then in 1998, the Good Friday Agreement brought peace. You mentioned now Brexit. How much has Brexit really threatened all of that work that was done?
It has enormously undermined the Good Friday Agreement. The Good Friday Agreement relied upon the support of the United States, the European Union, and the British and Irish governments. The European Union poured massive amounts of peace funding into Northern Ireland, for example, after the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. But since Britain has left Europe, the problem is that unionists in Northern Ireland kind of held out for a very hard Brexit, basically because they wanted a hard border back in Ireland. And one of the achievements of the Good Friday Agreement was to soften the border in Ireland. But obviously now that Northern Ireland is out of the European Union, there is going to have to be a border. So instead of it being across the island of Ireland, which the EU would not tolerate, and which indeed the US said it wouldn't tolerate either, the UK has drawn a new trade border down the Irish Sea, which is to an extent separating the United Kingdom from Northern Ireland, creating a sort of sense of it being a place apart.
Has that created resentment?
Yeah, unionists are very unhappy about this, and that is creating disturbance. On the other hand, a lot of people in Northern Ireland are thinking, well, first of all, we didn't want Brexit. A majority of people in Northern Ireland voted to remain in the European Union. But quite a lot of people, I think, are now thinking, well, if we became unified with the Republic of Ireland, we could rejoin the European Union, which might not be such a bad thing. It's something which is actively wanted by the nationalist community. But I found when I was researching my book that quite a lot of Protestants would not be terribly averse to the prospect either.
Really? Well, you know, it's not as if this is a surprise, right? I mean, I was in Northern Ireland in 2018 reporting on Brexit and the fears at the time that people thought it would be destabilizing. So in retrospect, do you think that the Brexiteers knew in their hearts that these tensions could return with Brexit, but just supported it anyways?
I think that the British government has shown a tremendous indifference to Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland has always fancied itself, according to its unionist majority, as being the most loyal part of the United Kingdom. And it's very staunchly British. I mean, you often hear people say who come to visit Northern Ireland from Britain that they're amazed by the number of Union flags, Union Jack flags that are flying everywhere. It probably speaks more of insecurity than anything else. We had an opinion poll in the United Kingdom just before the Brexit vote, which showed that British Conservative voters would rather lose both Scotland and Northern Ireland from the United Kingdom than give up on Brexit. So the commitment of the British government to Northern Ireland is not equal. It's not a mutually happy relationship. Northern Ireland is much keener to be part of the United Kingdom than the United Kingdom is to have Northern Ireland. So that's also causing a lot of disturbance and resentment among unionists.
So tell me, what would reunification look like if you think it is at all possible, considering the deep history of conflict between these two sides?
I think everybody accepts that it would be a long process. It's not something that could easily be achieved. And I think if we learned anything from Brexit, it was that just sudden referendums on big, complicated issues are not a good idea. Because people in the Republic don't really think very much about Northern Ireland on the whole, except people living in the border region. And the Irish government would need to become much more multicultural, much more open. The health and education services in the Republic are not really fit for purpose and would have to change a great deal. In Northern Ireland, we have the National Health Service, which is a system which allows people to, for example, just go to their doctor for a free appointment. There's no system like that in the Republic. One of the problems about it is that unionists are steadfastly refusing even to talk about it, you know, as if even talking about it would be a betrayal of their unionism and their beliefs and their identity.
And their identity. And to that point, what would become of the United Kingdom if Ireland was reunified and if Scotland got another shot at independence and moved forward on that?
Well, I think it's become very apparent that Brexit really was an English nationalist project. They didn't care. I mean, recently the Welsh First Secretary said that he believed that the union was breaking up. We know that there's a very strong movement in Scotland for independence. So I think that what we're seeing is the outcome of a very, very narrow policy by the British Conservative government to have an independent England. And it has been quite careless of Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland.
Susan McKay is author of the recent book Northern Protestants on Shifting Ground. Her essay, The End of Northern Ireland, in the New York Times. We'll link you to it at hereandnow.org. Susan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Baseball's top players gather in Denver tonight for the first All-Star game since before the pandemic. Last night, fans packed a sold-out Coors Field for the Home Run Derby to see New York Mets slugger Pete Alonso rack up 74 home runs.
One more to win it as Alonso comes out of the timeout and walks it off. What a finish. Alonso defends his title.
That sound from ESPN. Alonso outlasted Trey Mancini of the Baltimore Orioles in the final round. Chelsea Janes is national baseball reporter for the Washington Post. Chelsea, I'm lucky enough to have attended an All-Star Week home run derby some years ago, and it is just big, bombastic fun. And man, Pete Alonso's performance certainly delivered the goods.
You know, he is the epitome of big and bombastic home run fun. It seems like he is one of these rare players that come along every, you know, decade or so who lives for the home run derby. It's something a lot of guys don't care about, don't want to be a part of, but he was a showman. He made it look easy, and there was sort of very little doubt once he started hitting that was the way things were going to go.
Trey Mancini was the runner-up, but he actually may be an even better story. I mean, the fact that he was even there at all.
Absolutely. You know, he is a year removed from colon cancer, and, you know, he is someone who wasn't sure that he would be playing baseball, you know, a year ago, and has somehow been able to get himself not only back and back from cancer, but back on the field and performing at a level that earned him a chance to be at the Home Run Derby. And, you know, he looked like he belonged. I think he would have been perfectly happy just hitting a few home runs and going out in the first round. But, you know, he and his family were just overjoyed after the game, taking pictures on the field. I think they were some of the last to leave, and it's really special. He's touched a lot of people who are fighting or have even kind of succumbed to cancer, and I think, you know, a lot of people will look at him for years to come as someone who can show you what's possible, even when things are looking tough.
So for some of us, it's enough that we're now into something close to normal as far as the baseball season goes. The limits on the numbers of fans inside stadiums are gone or going away. But on top of that, the plot lines, like Trey Mancini, have been really, really compelling this year. And I'm building up to the story of one Shohei Ohtani, who plays for the Los Angeles Angels and who will be doing something unheard of tonight. Talk about that.
Ohtani is going to both start the All-Star game as a pitcher tonight, and he is also going to lead off for the American League hitting tonight. And that is something we have never seen before, not since Babe Ruth, not since some of the great two-way stars of the Negro Leagues decades and decades ago. Has there been a player who has been able to pitch and hit at an all-star level. And, you know, those players back in the day didn't get the chance to do it on this stage. So Shohei said last night that, you know, he knows that Japan wants to see this. And he knows that the people of that country want to see, you know, their first Japanese player in the home run derby. They want to see him make history. And you can tell he's carrying a lot of weight on his shoulders. But so far, he has just not disappointed. And he's a once in a generation and maybe once in a lifetime talent.
And again, just so the casual fan doesn't miss what you're talking about, he'll be the leadoff hitter because he's a great hitter, and he'll be the starting pitcher, combining two skills that just don't go together.
Ohtani has 33 home runs, you know, in the first half. And so he is on pace to hit, you know, somewhere in the 60 home run range. If you remember in the late 90s, when Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa were breaking single season home run records, that was the range they were in. So this is the kind of talent we're talking about for him offensively. And he's not as good, you know, on the mound, but he's still elite. He still gets a lot of strikeouts. You know, I think the league understands the reach he has. And it was really interesting. A reporter from NHK in Japan yesterday asked him what he thinks he means to the Japanese people who are dealing with a coronavirus surge and who are all going to get up early to watch him in the Derby and the All-Star game. And he really seemed to feel that responsibility. And then later in the evening, he's out there hugging Juan Soto, this 22-year-old kid from the Dominican Republic. And it just shows you how the game has really brought people together. But I think Ohtani is someone that has the potential to really have a universal appeal like very few players ever kind of manage.
After really a year and a half without going to the ballpark because of the pandemic, I've been to a couple of games this year. But with that big break away from the park, going back now, it does feel to me like the way the game has changed is more noticeable. There's better pitching, there's more strikeouts, lots of home runs, but fewer rallies. I don't know if it's better or worse, but it does feel different. Your thoughts?
It's certainly different. And I think that there's not as much in-game action, not as many, you know, balls put in play as there have been in previous years. And it's noticeable. And it's something that the league is going to be continually experimenting with and trying to even out, I think, probably not only for the rest of this season, but into next season and beyond.
Chelsea Janes is national baseball reporter for The Washington Post. She's in Denver for tonight's All-Star game. Chelsea, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Don Gagne.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.